This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. If you told me, when I took this job, that one day I would be publishing a long story about UFOs, I probably would have guessed we were talking about some sort of humor piece by Patty Marks or Ian Fraser. I wouldn't have imagined that we'd be publishing thousands and thousands of words on serious government programs investigating UFOs, or quoting officials on the record to the effect that UFOs are a pressing issue of national security. But times change. And Gideon Lewis Krause, a staff writer, has just published exactly that kind of piece in The New Yorker. Here's Gideon.
One afternoon in mid-April, I was at the playground with my son when I got a frantic text message from one of my sources. "Breaking huge UFO news," it said. And there was a link to a website that had a series of photos and a video of some green glowing triangles against the starry night sky. At this point, I'd been working on a story about UFOs for 4 or 5 months, and it wasn't so unusual for me to get these kinds of texts with these kinds of links to grainy footage of dubious provenance. But what was really weird about the triangle video was what happened the next day. The Pentagon came out and said yes, in fact, this was ours. The video was allegedly shot from the deck of the USS Russell off the coast of San Diego in 2019. In the weeks since, some people have cast doubt on the video, and it probably doesn't show a UFO. But the point of the story is, the triangle video made international headlines.
In night vision video from a Navy destroyer, a mysterious flying triangle above the deck of the ship, the Pentagon confirming the images obtained by documentary...
All of a sudden, UFOs were something that people talked about.
Guys. Okay, that's crazy.
You know, I don't want to say I don't believe because I don't want them to come prove me wrong.
For the first time in decades, it had once again become perfectly reasonable to admit that you were interested in UFOs.
You know, it's kind of like you can chase your tail on this story.
John Podesta was chief of staff in the Clinton White House, and then he served as an advisor to President Obama. And for a long period of time, he was one of the few visible public officials who was willing to speak out about government transparency and UFOs.
I think it was sort of viewed as a career-ending event that you'd be viewed as someone who is a little bit nutty. People would accuse you of seeing little green men around the corner, so people avoided it.
Over the last few years, there's been an enormous and rapid change in the way the government addresses the UFO topic. And all of that is expected to culminate this June, when the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force is expected, with the participation of the Director of National Intelligence and the Secretary of Defense, to produce a report about what the government does and does not know about UFOs.
I give Senator Reid a lot of credit for this.
Harry Reid, the former Senate Majority Leader.
He pushed to have the Pentagon start a small program to basically collect the information. And lo and behold, there was information collected and then it was released. And I think Leslie Kane, her dogged reporting on the issue had something to do with it.
In late 2017, Leslie Kane brought a bombshell story to editors at the New York Times. The article, which appeared in December of that year and was written with two other reporters, revealed the existence of a secret Pentagon program funded by black money that had long looked into the existence of UFOs. She is so proud of her work that she has a copy of the article framed on her wall.
Yeah, I mean, the first one was in December 2017, which is over here. That was the one that blew the lid off.
Can you read us the UFO headline?
Topic. Yeah, well, the print headline is "Real UFOs? Question mark. Pentagon unit tried to know," which actually is a much better headline than the one that was online, which was kind of stupid. Of course, I guess
that was the one about glowing auras.
Glowing auras or whatever. And that's what set the whole thing in motion.
Leslie Kane has been on the UFO beat for more than 20 years. Her 2010 book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, was a bestseller. The office in her apartment doubles as a kind of archive. And if you're looking for any kind of official document about a UFO case or encounter dating back to the 1940s, she almost certainly has it close at hand. There's actually a photograph, a black and white photograph on the wall behind you. Can you tell us about that photograph? What is that a photograph of?
I love this photograph. It's probably the best photograph of a UFO ever taken. It was taken in the 70s from a government mapping plane in Costa Rica, which had a camera strapped on the bottom of the plane, and it was like going over the terrain. There was this disc object, and you can clearly see the sun reflecting off this round object. It's got a little dot on the top. And what's important about it is that it was a government photo. There's a clear chain of custody. It's always been in the possession of the Costa Rican government. So, you know it's authentic, and it's completely unexplained.
It might seem astonishing that the culture has become so open to the UFO conversation. But when the sightings first began, roughly speaking in the late 1940s or so, they weren't dismissed so quickly. This was the beginning of what Leslie calls the golden age of UFOs. In 1947 alone, there were close to 1,000 official sightings.
Airline pilots with thousands of hours experience have reported saucers coming within a few hundred feet of their planes, matching speed briefly, and then darting off at supersonic speed, leaving a glowing exhaust trail.
In 1947 alone, there were close to 1,000 sightings.
They hung there in the sky, and they were, to us, had the appearance of tubes of fluorescent light.
The U.S. was in the grip of a flying saucer mania.
A beautiful, silvery, pink-tinged moonlight.
This is Edward R. Murrow. We're going to talk about flying saucers.
The prevailing scientific attitude was that UFOs didn't exist because they couldn't exist.
My thought is simply that the ability of some people to kid themselves is extraordinary.
But it was also the beginning of the Cold War, and members of the military, at least in private, took it much more seriously than they were generally willing to let on.
So Lieutenant General Nathan Twining was the commander of Air Force Material Command, so he was a high-level Air Force guy. And he sent a memo around, and the title of the memo was Flying Discs.
This was a lieutenant general in the Air Force who later went on to become chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
He stated that the phenomenon, this is the line that's really famous from this memo, the phenomenon reported is something real and not visionary or fictitious. So it was that memo that led to the founding of Project Blue Book.
Project Blue Book ran from 1952 through the end of 1969. And for the first few years, at least, it really did try to chase down what was going on with these sightings.
In Washington, ghost-like objects dart across the radar screen at the CAA Traffic Control Center at National Airport for several hours, traveling more than 100 miles...
The National Archives have 37 cubic feet of cases from Project Blue Book. Each cubic foot is about 2,000 pages.
General Sanford, Air Force Intelligence Director, confirms that the objects are not secret American weapons and reiterates the Air Force's obligation to investigate.
Since 1947, we have received and analyzed between 1 and 2,000 reports that have come to us from all kinds of sources. Of this great mass of reports, we have been able adequately to explain the great bulk of them, explain them to our own satisfaction. However, there have been a certain percentage of this volume of reports that have been made by credible observers of relatively incredible things.
By the time it shut down, Project Blue Book had logged more than 12,000 cases. In the end, 701 of them remained officially unexplained. That's an average of about 40 cases for every year that the project ran. My understanding, and I think I drew this from your book, is that the view of at least many influential high-level officials was that it wasn't that UFOs themselves were the problem, it was that the UFO reports were the problem. That there were too many UFO reports, and that Blue Book had to do something to handle just that volume of UFO reports.
Yes, the concern about all the reports and all the attention was really an issue, and that's why the CIA convened this panel in 1953 called the Robertson Panel, in which they sort of set up a policy to debunk UFOs. And that was sort of that's when the train left the station in terms of this sense of ridicule that goes through decade after decade after decade, but it was kind of put in place by the CIA panel.
So the CIA was working actively to undermine the belief in UFOs. But by then, a fascination with flying saucers had become just part of the culture.
UFOs were being written about all the time in the mainstream media.
One of the times that I visited you, you showed me a bunch of those vintage magazine covers, stuff from Life and Look and the Saturday Evening Post. Can we look at some of those?
Yeah.
Are those easy enough to find?
Yeah, right over here. So let's see. Here's one.
Read that headline.
This one?
Yeah.
Luminous pulsating shapes that hover in the night.
And there are
That's
a bunch
a pretty good description of a UFO.
And there are a bunch of great photographs here that sort of look like beetles in the sky.
I know. This is the swamp gas case.
The swamp gas case near Ann Arbor, Michigan in March of 1966 was a pivotal moment.
The most spectacular sighting was last Sunday night when, witnesses say, a mysterious lighted object spent several hours in the swampland behind this pasture.
More than 100 people reported it.
Its third appearance in less than a week.
There's an amazing video of this witness.
Are you sorry now that you did tell people what you saw?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry because it's not the truth, but it's just the idea, the reaction of the people. They think you're a nut. Tell you the truth, that's just what they figure you are. And I'm not going to take it no more. I don't want nobody down in here. I just leave me alone. And if the thing lands right there by that pump, I'd never say a word.
Project Blue Book's in-house scientist, the astronomer J. Allen Hynek, was dispatched to investigate. He found a community in a state of what he called near hysteria.
And the lights were still fluctuating and seemed to be rotating, and it was hovering. And then we saw three lights that went...
Under pressure to avert panic, he called a press conference at which he said that the orbs that had been seen were mistaken cases of the planet Venus or other astronomical bodies, and that other things could be explained by the spontaneous decomposition of vegetation, or what he called marsh gas.
I want it clearly understood that I'm not making a blanket statement to cover the entire UFO phenomenon over the past 20 years in this and other countries.
Doctor, could you face this way more?
Yeah, all right.
Thank you.
I emphasize in conclusion that I cannot prove in a court of law that marsh gas is the full explanation of these sightings. But it does appear to me extremely likely. I am, after all, an astronomer and not a chemist.
It was inevitable that there was going to be a clash between a public who generally believed in the existence of UFOs and a government whose official policy was one of skepticism. Swamp gas became a kind of shorthand for official contempt. Gerald Ford, who was then the House Minority Leader, was outraged on behalf of his constituents. He thought that this was an affront to their dignity, and he called for congressional hearings to look into whatever it was that was going on. He thought that the Air Force explanations that had been provided were clearly insufficient.
Mr. Secretary, there have been charges that the Air Force is hiding something in the UFO field. What is that, if anything?
We have not been hiding anything. The investigation...
And by the end of that summer, it was determined that some independent outside body should be commissioned to get to the bottom of whatever was going on.
Gideon Lewis Krause. His report on UFOs and how they became somehow a part of the national agenda once again continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In June, the Department of Defense is expected to release a report on unidentified aerial phenomenon. And the report's purpose is to explain what the government does and doesn't know about UFO sightings after 70-plus years. To understand how this got on the national agenda in the first place, we're hearing from Gideon Lewis Krause, who's reporting for The New Yorker. Just a moment ago, Gideon described a notorious incident in Michigan where more than 100 people reported hovering lights over a marsh near Ann Arbor. There were public hearings, and eventually Congress authorized a commission to write a report. Gideon Lewis Krause takes it from here.
The government commission was based out of the University of Colorado. It was headed up by a scientist named Edward Condon, who was a very prominent figure. He was a nuclear physicist. Condon made it quite clear, long before the study was completed, that he thought this whole UFO business was absolute bunk.
Dr. Condon, what sorts of things do you think people will be reporting to you that they're seeing?
Well, I presume they'll the same sort of things that they have been reporting for the last 20 years, and those are bright stars and meteors and the moon shining through clouds and...
By the time the Condon report appeared in 1969, its conclusions were foreordained. But the report itself is something really strange. It's over 1,000 pages long, and the only parts that Professor Condon wrote were the summary and the recommendations and conclusions. And it almost seemed like he hadn't read the rest of it. Because of the 90 Blue Book cases that the Condon Committee chose to look up, 30 of them remained at the end unexplained. One of them was attributed to a mechanical device of unknown origin under intelligent control. There was nothing about the Condon report that suggested that the phenomenon should be dismissed out of hand, and yet that was Condon's recommendation, that there was no reason to entertain further scientific study, that nothing would be gained by the study of unidentified flying objects, and that it's something the government should just leave alone.
It was like, you know, putting the nail in the coffin.
That's journalist Leslie Kane again.
And so anybody from then on who wanted to stay away from it could just cite the Condon report.
Hi. All right. You think that there's some sort of genetic
motive, some sort of genetic motive behind all they are doing with human abduction. Is that correct?
From that point on, UFO discourse was dominated by talk of alien abductions, alien corpses, secret hangars at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, ancient alien astronauts, alien bases under the sea, massive government conspiracies, the Majestic 12, a group of 12 men who had been convened in secret by President Truman in the interest of national security to protect Americans from our true secret dealings with galactic civilizations.
You've been a surrogate mother for aliens three times.
At least. I think it's more like seven times.
Seven times?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
All of this stuff is what dominates UFO discussions for the next 50 years. Until 2017, when Leslie Kane dropped her bombshell report. In October of 2017, you were called to a hotel bar near the Pentagon.
Not really a bar, but anyway. A hotel lobby space
yeah. Near the Pentagon. And who was there and what did you learn?
Well, the main reason for that meeting was for me to meet Luis Elizondo, who was the former head of the Department of Defense program, and Christopher Mellon, who was a former Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence at the Pentagon, was there, and a former CIA person. And it was at that meeting that I was first shown the videos, the three videos that eventually came out, as well as a lot of documents that established the reality of the program.
This man, Luis Elizondo, was a former counterintelligence officer. He'd been running a secret program at the Pentagon for years studying UFOs. That program had begun in 2007. When Nevada Senator Harry Reid had found $22 million in black money appropriations to set up an investigation into the reality of the phenomenon.
Well, I came to the realization, in spite of all my staff telling me to stay the hell away from it, that it was something that had to be done.
That's Harry Reid.
I think it would have been a legislative malpractice for me not to get involved. And in hindsight, it hasn't hurt me politically. In fact, I can go today in one of the hotels here in Vegas and someone will say, "Are you Harry Reid?" And I'll say, "Yes." And they'll say, "Thank you very much for your work on flying saucers."
The program that Reid funded did a lot of things, but one of its chief preoccupations was looking into the futuristic technologies that would have to be behind a UFO with the sorts of flight characteristics that had been observed. The operative question was, if you were the Pentagon and wanted to build your own flying saucer, how would you go about doing that?
And there were lots of people at higher levels who made it difficult for them, who didn't think this was appropriate, that they were even studying it. People had attitudes. There were also people who had religious attitudes about this, who had a lot of power, who didn't believe that UFOs were something that we should be studying for religious reasons. So,
right, because they think that they could be demons.
Demonic or something like that.
Luis Elizondo felt sidelined by the neglect of his work from Pentagon higher-ups. He never got to brief the Secretary of Defense, and in his mounting frustration, he publicly resigned. A few days later, he met with Leslie Kane at that hotel near the Pentagon. She left that meeting with three videos from the project.
Well, if there's a thing, it's rotating.
One of them shows a small white object moving at a rapid clip against a gunmetal background. What was your experience with the Pentagon in those years? Did it seem to you like the DOD was pushing back against investing in these questions, or did they seem cooperative?
The Pentagon, yes, they did push back. The higher-ups thought this was goofiness. But now the Pentagon has changed dramatically. Now they're asking their pilots to report these things. That's why we learned about the pyramids that were floating around. And captains of ships now are able to speak out.
One question that I have has to do with this issue of potential retrieved crash debris that was reported on last summer. I mean, it certainly seems like many of the figures you've described, like Lou Elizondo, you know, he went on Tucker Carlson and Carlson said, do you believe that, you know, there's compelling evidence of, you know, that we have retrieved crash debris? And Elizondo said yes.
Well, I don't know what he knows, but he must know something I don't know because I cannot confirm all that.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like anybody really knows of any, but, you know, certainly, I mean, my guess is that you and I have both heard the same stories. I mean, there are these stories that circulate that some people at least find pretty credible and compelling.
Well, that's, I have no problem with that. I personally can't confirm that. And I think that it's people can come up with a little more clear foundation on that. I'll like it even more. But right now, I haven't seen that. And I was told for decades that Lockheed had some of these retrieved materials. And I tried to get, as I recall, a classified approval by the Pentagon to have me go look at the stuff. They would not approve that. I don't know what all the numbers were and what kind of classification it was, but they would not give that to me.
Did they give you a reason for that?
No, they didn't have to. They just, it was a yes or no, and it was a no.
Okay, to be clear, Harry Reid is not saying that he knows for a fact that some private military contractor somewhere in an obscure hangar has crash debris retrieved from a UFO. He did, however, suspect enough substance in these rumors that he personally tried to get to the bottom of them. And as Senate Majority Leader, he made an effort to secure Pentagon approval to go and visit these military contractors. He was denied. Now, the overwhelming likelihood is that this was just an elaborate, multi-generational game of murky Cold War flying saucer telephone, and that at some point we had, in fact, retrieved crash debris from a secret Soviet spy satellite, and that over time, in an atmosphere of opacity and paranoia, that became a story of secret UFO crash debris. It could be that, but now we're here.
I think some of the phenomena we're going to be seeing continues to be unexplained.
John Brennan, the former CIA director.
And could involve some type of activity that some might say constitutes a different form of life.
John Ratcliffe, the former director of National Intelligence.
There are a lot more sightings than have been made public. Some of those have been declassified. When we talk about sightings, we're talking about objects that have been seen by Navy or Air Force pilots or have been picked up by satellite imagery.
Senators like Mark Warner and Marco Rubio were briefed on all this stuff.
So, Senator, what about that? What can you tell us about UFOs?
Well, we have things flying over military installations, over military exercises and other places, and we don't know what it is. It isn't ours. It isn't anything that's registered with the FAA, and in many cases exhibits attributes of things we've never seen, technology, the kinds of technology we haven't seen before, or at least that's what it seems like. I think you have to know what it is, or we have to try to know what it is. That's my view of it, without any preconceived notions. Maybe there's a logical explanation. Maybe it's something that can be explained away. Maybe it's a foreign adversary who's made a technological leap. Whatever it is, we need to know the answer to it.
That's a former serious presidential candidate talking. But Rubio has gone further. He oversaw the introduction of language in last year's Intelligence Authorization Act, which was passed in December, that stipulated that the Director of National Intelligence, along with the Secretary of Defense, had 180 days to produce a comprehensive report about what the government did and did not know about UFOs.
Part of the problem has been, heretofore, nobody was collecting this information, and it wasn't being reported to any central authority. So to this day, we still don't know what we know.
Chris Mellon was a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for both the Clinton and Bush administrations. He helped break Leslie Kane's reporting on the Pentagon's secret program.
I don't think they're going to indicate anything to do with aliens. I don't think that hypothesis is going to be referenced at all. But I don't think they're going to be able to say that there's no potential threat to national security. I really doubt that the Russians or Chinese could be that far ahead of us. It looks like centuries ahead.
Nobody wants to use the word aliens. But Mellon says that if our adversaries really had the technology to build the objects that have been observed, we would know about it. So what does that leave?
There's no combustion engineering. There's no air intake. There's no exhaust. There's no wings. They fly at elevations from outer space down to the surface and then hovering. One of the things the task force is starting to do is wants to go back and look at some of these databases, which are actually designed to exclude aircraft that don't meet a conventional known profile, like a conventional missile or jet. So they won't even display that on the radar operator's scope, even though the system's detecting and recording something going, say, 7,000 miles an hour. So it's hard to come up with a hypothesis to explain that without considering the possibility that some other civilization is involved.
The vast majority of the time, the experience of reporting describes a familiar arc from near complete ignorance to at least the performance of some expertise on a subject. But my experience here has been the complete opposite, that I feel like the more I look into this, the less I know about it. The more people I talk to, the more confused I become. This is a subject that my experience in reporting this piece has not been that of clearing up a mystery, but of deepening it.
Gideon Lewis Krause. His reporting on UFOs, or as they're sometimes called, unidentified aerial phenomenon, is at NewYorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come today. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We move on today to a story about three women, three revolutionaries who changed the world at a time when women weren't supposed to be in public life at all.
The alteration of the Constitution to perpetuate slavery, the enforcement of a law to recapture a poor, suffering fugitive, giving half of the territories of a free country to the curse of slavery, these compromises cannot be approved by God or supported by good men.
One of the women, a committed abolitionist, was Frances Seward. She'd settled with her husband in the small town of Auburn, New York, and among their neighbors was a Quaker, a mother of six named Martha Coffin Wright.
Although she dressed plainly and kept her house impeccable, she didn't take her family to church on Sunday or spank her children, who were regarded as rude and wild. Provoked by disapproval, Martha placed a copy of Mary Wollstonecraft's A Vindication of the Rights of Woman on her parlor table, where, she said, it was sure to shock guests.
Frances Seward and Martha Coffin Wright bonded over politics. Martha helped organize the first convention for women's rights at Seneca Falls, and both opened their homes to fugitive slaves when that was absolutely against federal law. They were friends with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, William Lloyd Garrison, and Frederick Douglass. But it was another neighbor of theirs in Auburn who got closest to Martha and Frances.
We have been expending our sympathies as well as congratulations on 7 newly arrived slaves that Harriet Tubman has just pioneered safely from the southern part of Maryland. One woman carried a baby all the way and brought 2 other children that Harriet and the men helped along. They walked all night carrying the little ones and spread the old comfort on the frozen ground in some dense thicket where they all hid while Harriet went out foraging.
The interlocking stories of Harriet Tubman, Frances Seward, and Martha Coffin Wright are told in the book The Agitators, and its author is by friend and colleague Dorothy Wickenden. Frances Seward grew up in the North. She was educated. She was married to William Henry Seward, who was Abraham Lincoln's future Secretary of State. And she and Seward agreed about slavery, but she'd never been South until she took a summer trip through Virginia with him and one of their sons. Tell me about that trip and why it was so important and essential to your book.
It was that she had a real epiphany on that trip. Seward himself had been South, and so he had seen slavery firsthand. She had not. She was a typical woman. She spent all of her time at home, inside. So for her health, because her health was poor, they decided to take a long, leisurely summer trip into the South. As they entered Virginia, they noticed that it was, you know, basically 100 years behind the industrial North, which is what they were familiar with. And one day they pulled up in the afternoon outside basically a country inn, and they heard the sounds of moaning and crying. And they turned around and they saw 10 naked little boys tied together by a long rope and being driven forward by a white man with a whip. And he led them to a horse trough to drink. And then he shoved them inside a shed where they sobbed themselves to sleep. So Frances was devastated, but she couldn't get this scene out of her mind. She wrote in her journal, "Slavery, slavery, the evil effects constantly before me."
But I guess, Dorothy, what's so stunning to me in this book is that we, a modern audience, we take it for absolute granted, unless we're freakishly marginal or evil, that slavery is horrific, a horrific evil inflicted on other people. And it's impossible almost to put yourself in the mindset of a person who had to experience it firsthand and it came as a revelation to her. How do you explain that?
Well, for Frances, she was 19 when she married Seward, but one of the things that had drawn them together were their deeply moral beliefs, one of which was, you know, the rights of women, the other of which was, you know, sooner or later, slavery must be overturned. That one of the remarkable things, though, that I noticed when I was writing the book, and even since it's come out, is that people still don't find slavery such a terrible thing. Look at what we saw at the Capitol on January 6th. There are still people who are wedded to the lost cause theory of American history. We saw people marching through with Confederate flags. This is very deeply part of what America is, and this is what they were fighting against. And they would be horrified but not surprised that even today this is an issue.
How did you settle on this as a subject, and also the challenge of doing a three-cornered biography, as it were, which is a technical challenge too?
Yeah, and if I had anticipated quite how difficult that was, I probably wouldn't have taken it on in the first place. So the book came about serendipitously. I was actually working on my previous book, which was, as you know, about my grandmother who grew up in Auburn, New York, and she had told me that her grandparents lived next door to William H. Seward, and I thought, well, well, maybe she kind of made that one up. I don't know. So I had never been to Auburn before. I went there. I went to the Seward House Museum, and I asked the director, did the Woodruffs like live next door? And he pointed out William H. Seward's study window, and he said, yep, the house was right there. And then there was this young education director who sort of took me under her wing, and she wanted to give me a private tour. And she takes me down these dark, narrow steps into the original basement kitchen. And she's talking not about the famous, amazing William H. Seward, but about his quiet, recessive, rather sickly wife, Frances Seward. And she was pretty mad because she had been reading some letters by Frances Seward to her husband. And she thought that all of the Seward biographers had really undersold his wife. So she takes me into this basement kitchen. She said, this is where Frances Seward harbored fugitive slaves on the Underground Railroad. And I thought, well, that's kind of amazing. And she said, and furthermore, around the corner, her best friend lived, who was another outlier in very conservative Auburn. Her name was Martha Coffin Wright. And she, like Frances Seward, believed that women should have equal rights and that slavery needed to be abolished. And both of those ideas were completely ridiculous at the time. This was the early, you know, late 1830s, early 1840s.
Frances and Martha were some of the earliest feminists in the country. What was the relationship between the early feminist movement, the women's rights movement, and the abolitionist movement? It was not always in sync, and there were tensions.
There were tensions from the beginning, including when women asked if they could join William Lloyd Garrison's group, the American Anti-Slavery Society, and they were roundly told they could not, so they started their own female anti-slavery societies. However, these women learned a lot from their male abolitionist colleagues. They learned how to organize. They learned how to hold conventions and invite speakers. They learned how to petition Congress. And then they would invite people like Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison to speak at their conventions, which those who believed in women's rights were very happy to do. However, there were always racial tensions kind of simmering under the surface. So, say, when Lucy Stone, who was one of Martha Coffin Wright's friends, she was a paid speaker for Garrison's group. She decided to go south to speak to slaveholders because, in her view, this was a good thing to do, open their minds. And Frederick Douglass was really angry. He said he did not think this was a moral thing to do. So anyway, all of this was kind of simmering. Usually they were able to keep a lid on it, but it eventually broke right out into the open in an incredibly ugly way. But that was much later, after the war in the 1860s and the debate around the 15th Amendment.
Now let's bring the person that I think everybody will have heard of when they encounter this book, and that's Harriet Tubman. How does Harriet Tubman fit into this picture?
So, and this was one of the things that made me really want to write the book because, you know, we're told stories and we learned a little bit about Harriet Tubman in grade school, usually. Oh, she was the great conductor on the Underground Railroad. All true. Total American hero. But we didn't learn that much more about her. And when I learned that she had spent almost the last 50 years of her life in Auburn, New York, I thought, you know, how did she end up in Auburn? And she ended up in Auburn through her two contacts on the Underground Railroad, which was these other two women. And she would stop. They became regular stops on her railroad, Underground Railroad journeys, and she became very close to them both.
Here's what I don't understand. And maybe you're going to blame me for being too New York City centric, but why in God's name was Auburn, New York, of all places, a kind of Greenwich Village of its time, this kind of crossroads of politics and culture in the way that Greenwich Village was, and how could that happen?
You are betraying your parochialism, actually. And I would, Auburn was not remotely like Greenwich Village, if only it were. Yes, there were
these.
But
it's incredibly lively. Or at least it is in the Agitators.
Yes, because it was on the Lyceum circuit. But actually, Auburn was peopled by, as were many of these towns in Western New York State, by conservatives. These were bankers and industrialists and, you know, people pushing the railroads. And Frances was very sub rosa about her activities. Martha was incredibly outspoken. And she, at Seneca Falls, she met Frederick Douglass, and she immediately befriended him. And he did speak on the Lyceum circuit across New York State, and he often stopped in Auburn. She would invite him to her house to dinner and sometimes to spend the night, because he was usually hotels were not welcoming to Black men. For this, she was completely reviled by her neighbors, who already thought she was just outrageously, you know, subversive. And she was at one at dinner once in Auburn, and she hears this woman whispering to another woman, "That is Mrs. David Wright. She is a very dangerous woman." And that's because she was socializing with people like Frederick Douglass.
Well, how did Auburn, New York, take to a woman like Harriet Tubman's arrival?
Well, so, but Harriet Tubman, you have to remember, in the 1850s, all of this was completely unknown. If her neighbors had known that she was sheltering fugitive slaves and that Frances was doing the same, you know, they would have reported them to the authorities. This was completely against the law. The Fugitive Slave Act required northern states to return fugitive slaves to the South, and that was the, one of the big precipitating factors of this growing activism. It actually got even many of these conservatives in New York State really riled up about slavery. These are people who had never thought of it before.
Your book starts with a quotation from Harriet Tubman, and it says, "God's ahead of Master Lincoln. God won't let Master Lincoln beat the South till he does the right thing." And there's a feeling in the book that the Civil War was, in a way, two wars, the military battle with the Confederacy and a moral battle against slavery, and that winning the military battle required winning the moral battle at the same time. Is that how these women saw the entire conflict?
Harriet Tubman and the other two all saw the Civil War. They called it a holy war as of old. Each one of them believed deeply that God meant for slavery to be abolished. The difference between them and Francis Seward's anti-slavery husband and Abraham Lincoln at the beginning of the war, those two were politicians. These people were outsiders, and they were revolutionaries. And it's worth remembering that they were only two generations separated from the Declaration of Independence, which they believed in literally. And they did not understand why women and Black Americans could not have exactly the same rights that had been promised in the Declaration of Independence.
So, Dorothy, it's got to be said that these women made very different contributions to the causes of freedom. Frances and Martha raised awareness and money and, in a sense, lobbied powerful men for change. And that was very important, no doubt. But meanwhile, Harriet Tubman was putting her life on the line, helping people escape slavery, and she even took part in some military operations. How did you come to think about the different ways that these women worked?
Well, for one thing, David, I think it's important to put Harriet Tubman in a category all her own. There is no one who did anything like what Harriet Tubman did. The mere fact of her going back into the place where she had been enslaved for 27 years of her life, a dozen times, putting her life in danger and the life of those she was helping to escape from slavery, and taking them all completely safely, sometimes all the way back to Canada, was just something that, that other people did not do. So that was one thing. I think it's important to see that everyone had his or her part to play. And Martha, with her outgoing, very blunt personality, she threw herself into both movements, the abolitionist movement and the women's rights movement, and she became one of the great leaders of both. She, you know, and she spoke before mobs. I mean, people, you'd stand up on the platform and people would throw Bibles at you and, you know, hiss. And she, it took a lot of courage. Frances was very cerebral, very retiring, but she became more and more and more enraged by all of these injustices. She was, her husband, her very liberal-minded husband, even though he believed in women's rights, he actually would not allow her to sign petitions, do any of the things that a lot of the other activists were doing. So instead, she channeled her rage into her letters to him. And boy, those letters are really something, especially as the war gets underway and he is resisting you know, the abolition of slavery, and she accuses him of betraying every ideal he's ever stood for. She said, "You will go down in history like Daniel Webster, you know, who died a dishonored death." That was a pretty cruel blow. So all of these efforts together were what, over the course of the 1850s, created the Second American Revolution, which was these two great movements of the 19th century, the women's rights movement and the abolition movement.
Dorothy, finally, the figures in this book, do they serve as inspiration to any modern political activists or figures, do you find?
Yeah, so one of my on my desktop here, I have a photograph that one of my friend, well, actually one of our writers, took early on because we were in a conversation about the book and she was interested in Tubman, and you know those army green mail collection boxes. She took on the streets of New York. She took a picture of one and plastered all over it were these decals with a photograph of Harriet Tubman, and under each one it said Harriet Tubman, total badass, and I just love that because it's so shows how people continue to relate to her. And what I kept realizing over the years as I was writing the book is that these women and all of their friends, men too, were organized, showed how to organize a major social movement. How do you do it? Well, it's grassroots organizing. And we are seeing versions of the exact same thing play out today. So there's a lot of, in my book, there's a lot of wife battering. And so when the Me Too movement suddenly sprung up, I thought, well, it's about time. I mean, this has been going on for a very long time. And of course, Black Lives Matter. Look at the political effects that Black Lives Matter has had in recent years. And one hopes that it will continue to have.
Dorothy Wickenden, thank you so much. The book is wonderful. It's The Agitators.
Thanks a lot, David. Great talking to you.
Dorothy Wickenden is the author of The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Human Rights. It's out now. And in her free time, Dorothy is executive editor at The New Yorker. That's our program for today, and I want to thank you for listening. Next time, we'll tag along with critic Hilton Alls visiting his first museum show since the pandemic started more than a year ago. I'm David Remnick. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses,
Annabelle Bacon,
and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann.
This week's episode features additional music by Pablo Vergara, and we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.